Good afternoon. This is the Subcommittee on General Government for Full Ways and Means. It's May 26th, and we have an informational hearing this afternoon, and several people that are signed up to speak. And our informational hearing is on state and local government credit card terms. And so I believe, Cora, are you our first speaker? Well, come on up. Oh, yes, and Representative Gomberg, who was on this subcommittee in the past, is here with us today. And so if he asked really tough questions, he and Senator Wisnant are our pros on this. So we welcome you, and yes, please, let's get started.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cora Parker. I'm the Finance Director with the State Treasurer's Office. I have with me here today Sharon Prentice, who is actually our Senior Merchant Card Services subject matter expert, in addition to a variety of other roles that she plays. And I'll apologize up front. I will refer throughout the presentation usually to merchant cards instead of credit cards. I'll try to correct that, but it's just a term of art that I'm used to using. While I will provide most of the presentation today, Sharon is here to keep me honest when it comes to the day-to-day operational details of the program. I'll start by saying when we were first asked to prepare a presentation to share with the committee this afternoon, we were given approximately 70 minutes to present. That timeline was adjusted a few days ago. It was probably just about right for the breadth and depth of the information that we have to present. So we've tried to collapse it into 30 minutes, and we'll certainly do our best today. We've tried to provide a summary enough presentation that it hits all of the areas that you wanted to hear about, but enough details in those areas that we think the committee is most interested in. In addition to what we're going to cover here today, you'll also find a number of additional details in a memo that was provided to LFO and I think several members of the committee on March 17th of this year as well. We do believe that we can hit the 30-minute target, depending, of course, on the nature of the questions the committee might have throughout the presentation. And I may just skim over some slides in order to attempt to do that. As a reminder from our recent budget presentation overview, Treasury does act as the banking services provider for all state agencies, including providing a host of banking services for those agencies. Again, that provides for that one-to-many relationship instead of many-to-many relationship, and that results in service and pricing efficiencies. Agencies have a variety of...
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'm sorry to have a question so far, so early in the presentation, but when you said it speaks to pricing efficiencies, I think one of the things that some of us have been looking for is evidence of that, specifically in negotiating bank card charges. I at least liken this to the drug formulary, that if we have the buying power of the state of Oregon, we ought to get the best deal on the planet. And I hear about the price efficiencies. I don't see any evidence of price efficiencies.
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, I hope that the presentation actually speaks to some of those value adds today, in addition to the pricing value, if you will. And we're certainly available to attempt to provide additional information as we go on.
Well, Ms. Parker, I know there's a pony in there someplace. Just don't make me dig so hard. I want you to show me. When was the last time we negotiated the rate with our institutional bankers? When was the last time we got a price accommodation? When have they heard about the fact that maybe questions like this are being asked in the legislature and they've come with a new proposal? Those are the sorts of things that I'd like to see.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I do think we will address those issues throughout the presentation today.
Cool.
And keep me honest if I don't. So again, agencies have a variety of options available to them for accepting payments. I won't go through the entire list today, but credit and debit card acceptance is just one of those types of payment acceptance. It's always an agency business decision to use any or all of the options. Considerations include those relevant to client base, the volume and type of payments, resources available to collect payments.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Sorry.
Yeah, yes.
I think this is another thing I just want to flag for the discussion. When you say it's an agency prerogative to decide, I hope somebody out there in DAS land is listening. I would love to see some guidance to agencies about deciding. Not only does it annoy the customers if agency A accepts debit, credit, and agency B doesn't. I mean, I think we've gotten sophisticated enough that maybe some more global conversation with Treasury leadership and DAS to lead to a agency-wide policy would be very consumer-friendly to Oregonians.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I agree with you. I think Treasury and DAS are actually having that conversations with agencies, and that's why you see a number of agencies beginning to move into electronic payment types. In fact, the legislature has approved legislation over the course of the last several years that have allowed agencies to mandate those types. And there are a variety of considerations, a variety of discussions and guidance that Treasury provides. I can't speak for DAS specifically, but it is something that is very important to both agencies, and we do work closely with the underlying user agencies in exactly that venue and approach. So again, there are costs associated with all options. Some of those, like the administrative costs associated with the merchant card program, or are more discreetly visible. You can see on a line item, here are the merchant card costs that an agency had for a particular period of time. However, every single payment structure has costs associated with it, whether it's people or supplies or services associated with collecting payments under any of those streams. There is a cost or a series of costs approached related to that.
Yes. Sorry.
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson.
But I didn't tell you. You only get three.
I'll spend this last one. That's fine that there are costs associated. There are costs, and then there are costs. And I'm trying to figure out if the actual cost of using the card, I'm making these numbers up, is 1.6, and the agency just says, well, we'll round to 2. I don't know if all the agencies count in their administrative load the same factors. I don't know how arbitrary it is to bounce up the percentage that is assessed for those agencies that are looking to consumers to pick up some of the processing costs. And so I'd like that at least to be part of the more global conversation. It's going to annoy Oregonians more if it's 1.6 at agency A and it's 2.3 at agency B.
Madam Chair, Representative, would you like me to wait? Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, excuse me. I think we will address some of those issues. There are a variety of factors that cause those distinctions between costs across the agency, many of them that are actually driven by the consumer that is bringing their payment mode to the table, and we address those very discreetly in the slide presentations that we're about to move through. I think there may be some follow-up questions after we move through them, and I'm certainly willing to entertain them and help walk through them. But I did assume we would get those very questions because we've had some of those questions with Representative Gomberg, and I hope that we've addressed them through the presentation.
And I was just teasing.
Thank you. I was about to have a stroke.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Hopefully when you move forward, you can delineate the difference in your mind between the private sector and the public sector, because in the private sector, virtually every business on the planet is using credit and debit cards. Mm-hmm. And they're using it not because it is convenient, but they're using it because it's a cost saving. It's the cheapest way to do business. The easiest way to manage your accounts receivable is not have accounts receivable. The bank has accounts receivable. So if you, as you go through this, if you could delineate the difference, if there are differences between the public sector and the private sector, it would be very helpful.
Chair Nathanson and Senator Whitsitt, I think that's a very important factor. You're right, whether it's a merchant card acceptance or it's an ACH EFT transaction, those modes that just bring dollars into the state directly certainly are more beneficial than those that have a risk of return check or other issues. So understood, that's an important area.
Anytime you're in the private sector, anytime you put an account, anytime you create an accounts receivable or add a dollar to accounts receivable, there's a certain amount of it you know you're not going to get back. And I would assume that's pretty much true in the government.
Absolutely.
Too.
So moving to the current contract overview, again, Treasury maintains the master agreement for merchant card acceptance services by state agencies. The agreement is with U.S. Bank Elavon. The initial agreement was entered in September 2005. The latest renewal period was in October 2012, so that would have been the last point in time that we looked at those rates and a variety of the underrelated features. That said, we are in constant conversation with U.S. Bank Elavon, and in fact, Sharon has been working to gather information from other states, other contracts, so that we're prepared when we go into the 2016 procurement or renegotiation period, depending on which approach we take, and are prepared to force that even lower if evidence suggests that it needs to be.
Sure.
We had
yes, sir.
Was that latest renewal period, was that an RFP?
It was not an RFP. It was a pricing, an automatic renewal with pricing negotiation related underneath of it.
Thank you.
Yes.
How many more automatic renewals are there?
Do you know?
There aren't any. That's right, 2016.
Okay, so 2016 will be an RFP year then.
Okay, and I presume Elavon is the credit card processing arm or...
That's correct, Madam Chair, Senator Johnson. That's correct.
Okay.
The acquiring bank is the, I think, official.
The acquiring.
What's the relationship between U.S. and Elavon? Is it a subsidiary? Is it a contract relationship?
Yes. Elavon. Excuse me. Chairman Nathanson, Senator Johnson. Elavon is a fully owned subsidiary of U.S. Bank.
Okay.
Excuse me, could you pull the mic just slightly toward you, and you need to state your name for the record.
Okay, Sharon Prentice. U.S. Bank is the acquiring bank, and Elavon is the processor where all the card transactions are authorized and settled through.
Thank you.
Okay, the last amendment was in May 2015. That included the addition of an optional processing services by the vendor, and we'll actually discuss that briefly later in the presentation. As Sharon confirmed, the current end date for the contract without renewal is October of 2016. Again, under the contract, it covers acceptance of Visa, MasterCard, and Discover. American Express requires a separate agreement. It's kind of an oddity. There's minimal activity there. And Visa acceptance is by far the greatest of the card brand types accepted here in Oregon, or utilized here in Oregon, I should say. When an agency determines that it wants to accept credit card payments from its customers, it enters into a tri-party agreement with Treasury and U.S. Bank. They elect the type of card acceptance service. Will the card be present? That is the customer physically standing in front of an agency representative paying for the card, paying for the service or product? Is the card not present? That could be over the phone, online, via mail, etc. The agency then makes hardware choices or software choices that might be necessary and elects whatever additional payment processing service might be necessary to fit the business model. Will it need an online portal, for example? Does it need call center resources to collect information by phone? And we'll discuss all of those options in more detail in a few minutes. Again, agencies, the current contract provides that agencies pay a processing fee of 7 cents per transaction. That's regardless of the size of transaction or how the transaction is processed. Agencies may have other costs depending on the approach to acceptance that they choose. That's software, hardware, again, those online portal or other costs. But there are no additional ongoing fees to U.S. Bank beyond those for the provision of that service. Remember, we'll talk in a few minutes about industry-related interchange and assessment fees. Those are not covered here. They are not negotiated as part of our merchant services agreement. We were also asked to comment on other value added from the statewide contract. In addition to receiving volume pricing and economies of scale, instead of rates based on individual agency volumes, that's true not only for that per transaction processing fee, but that's also true for hardware and software costs that agencies may have. There are several fee categories that are routine for other customers, both private sector and other governments, to be charged that we have simply negotiated out of our contract. We simply do not pay them. And very importantly, I would argue this is probably one of the most important value adds for the statewide contract. We receive same-day funding into Treasury's account on behalf of agencies. Most private sector firms wait at least 48 hours for funds to be received. This availability means that funds are immediately available for investment in the Oregon Short-Term Fund, and that's not a small thing. U.S. Bank Elavon also works with us annually to do a strategic review of our accounts. They make recommendations for how agencies might improve their own processing in order to get even better rates in those categories that are driven by industry-generated fees. So what are those industry-generated fees? There are three primary categories: interchange fees, assessment fees, and processing fees. This slide is simply an overview, but the next several actually break it down. The interchange fee is paid to the cardholders, that's the customer's card-issuing bank. It is a percentage plus a transaction fee. It is a fee that is set by the card associations and includes a multiple-page list of possible charges based on a number of factors. The card brand, the card type, is it a commercial card, a consumer card, a rewards card? The example, those rewards that you might accumulate on your Disney reward Visa card that allow you to earn free trips to the Disney resort, they don't come free. They cost the businesses, or in our case, the state agencies that you do business with, because the cost to use that card is greater to the merchant that's accepting that card. Other factors include, what's the industry within which the transaction takes place? Is the card present, swiped, key entered, not present at all? These all relate to risks, and essentially the more inherent a risk, the greater the cost associated with the card. Transaction size can also impact this fee as well. It is a non-negotiable fee, and it makes up approximately 90% of the total cost of acceptance by merchants. The assessment fee is a fee set by the card associations and paid to the card associations. It is also non-negotiable. It's fixed at the card association level and does not change based on card type or transaction type. For Visa, it is 0.11% plus 0.0025. Again, very similar for both MasterCard and Discover. In an example of a $100 transaction, it would cost the merchant 11.25 cents if the customer used a Visa, 12.95 cents if they used a MasterCard, and 12.85 cents if they used a Discover card. And remember, that does not include the interchange fee that we just talked about above. There's more variability in that fee, and it is also considerably more than this fee. There are some other miscellaneous but less common fees that can also fall into this assessment fee category. It makes up approximately 7% of the total cost of acceptance to merchants. The processing fee is the third component. That is the 7 cents that we've negotiated with our vendor. And again, we've discussed that already, so I won't plan to spend any additional time on it.
Yes, Representative Gombert.
Thank you, Interim Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. I appreciate
I'm the B team.
I appreciate you breaking out the merchant fee into its various components, but let's go big picture for a moment if we could. My understanding is that the average amount that we pay in total for transacting credit card charges ranges from 1.1 to 1.9, with the overall statewide average being 1.6%. Does that sound like all of these different components combined add up to an average of 1.6%?
Chair Nathanson and Representative Gomberg, that is correct. And in fact, we hit that in a slide just a couple down from now.
Thank you.
Senator Woodson.
Thank you. Just to clarify then, of the 100% of in fee components, only 3% are negotiable.
Chair Nathanson, Senator Whitsitt, that is essentially true. That smallest component, that processing fee, is the only part that is negotiable for any merchant, really. The rest of them are industry-driven. They are set by the merchant associations. They are paid to either the underlying bank that provides the card or to the card brands themselves.
Thank you.
Is there, do you have information for us? I'm sorry, I didn't look elsewhere for it. Could you go back one, please? Do you have information on other states, what their state agencies are paying?
Chair Nathanson, we do have some information, as I said, as we prepare for the procurement that will be coming up in 2016. We're looking closely at that. It is very difficult to do a complete apples-and-apples comparison because they're all structured so differently. So we can look directly at what the processing fee distinction is across those states that have chosen to make the information public, and not all of them have. But they also have a variety of those other charges that I said we've negotiated to not pay at all, where they pay a variety of those. Some of them don't have same-day funding, while we have same-day funding. So what Sharon is working very hard to do right now as we prepare for that next procurement process is to really make sense of that and try and figure out where do we need to push. Because if you see a state that has, you know, a 6-cent processing fee, what does that really mean compared to what else, what other costs that they may have compared to their volumes, et cetera? So,
in other words, what was the value of
Correct.
The other negotiated
Absolutely.
Details? Okay. Thank you.
So moving forward, merchant accounts, we have 70 agencies. That includes our universities right now that are accepting credit or debit cards throughout the state. 752 active accounts or merchant IDs through which those cards are being processed and funds are accepted. And cards are accepted at both point of sale, online, through the mail, or by telephone. And again, that's all a business decision based on a number of factors. Payment products that are utilized include Visa, MasterCard, Discover, American Express, as well as PIN debit and Voyager cards. This is the slide that I was mentioning to Representative Gomberg. It shows sales and fees by agency merchant group for calendar year 2014 only. The information provided in our March memo shows this as well as more detail on other years, as well as some additional detail that falls underneath of it. And as Representative Gomberg pointed out, the agency discount effective rate, so that's the combination of all three of those card components, card fee components, is approximately 1.6%. And I would tell you that I believe that is a very good rate compared to what is available in the industry. I think really anything less than 2% is considered a very good rate. Moving on to merchant card activities, I wanted to provide a couple of examples of the types of acceptance by state agencies. An easy example of a point of sale acceptance relates to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and OLCC stores. These are fast-paced retail stores that where purchases are in person, so the card is present. There are 221 stores and 547 payment card terminals. Again, costs include all three of those merchant-related fees. They also include lease or purchase of the payment card terminals. Some real knife numbers, I believe these are 2014 numbers. There was just under $290 million in net sales related only to merchant cards. Transaction counts, just under 9 million transactions. An average transaction dollar amount of $32. Total merchant card fees were just under $4.4 million, and the effective rate there is just under 1.5%. And frankly, I think that number was reported erroneously as 1.8% on a prior spreadsheet that we had provided to LFO. Moving on to an online acceptance example. We chose to use the Oregon State Board of Nursing. Payment acceptance here would be for professional licensing fees. Payments are accepted via online website hosted by DAS through the e-government solution. Again, net sales just over 5 million. Transaction count at just under 35,000. The average transaction amount was a little over $150. The total merchant card fee amount was just under $58,000, with an effective fee rate of 1.1% for that group.
I need to pause here for just a moment. I'm noting that we're just approaching slide 17 of 30. I need to do a time check. We're going to take a very brief recess. We will come back out of recess now. Thank you, everybody. I needed to do a time check because there's an awful lot of good information being presented. I need to make sure that the committee has time to ask questions that they want to ask, but also get through four presentations.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Excuse me. If we could go back a couple of slides to the Merchant Agency Activities page. I'm trying to get a sense here of why some agencies are at 1.1 and some are at 1.8. And when looking over that, I see the agencies that seem to have the lowest amount of net sales, such as courts and parks, have a lower rate than agencies that have a higher volume of net sales. And that strikes me as counterintuitive. It would seem that we get a lower rate when we're doing more business rather than getting a lower rate when we do less business. Help me understand that.
Madam Chair, Representative Gomberg, I'll take a first attempt at it, and then I'll have Sharon provide additional information if she thinks I've missed something. Again, remember, there are components of what is brought to the table that we have no control over. So sometimes size of transaction itself actually has an impact. Again, card present versus card not present also impacts. So it could be that the higher volume are online versus card present. I mean, there are a variety of things that we'd have to dig in, I think, to each one of these underlying areas to really answer the question. And we certainly can do that. I think that's something that may be a better use of time to follow up on outside of this committee. But again, remember, the issue really is related to a number of industry-related fees and charges that, again, there's a host. When you look at that interchange fee, you well know, because you've got some expertise in this, there's, you know, a seven-page, I think, document that explains the variety of different costs that can be associated, many of which state agencies have no control over. Do you want to add anything?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Although I'd be very interested to learn if OLCC is doing a lot of online sales.
No, but remember that their transaction amounts are $32, so they're very low. So let me put it this way. Let's talk about the 7-cent fee. If I have a $2 million transaction or I have a $32 transaction, I still get charged 7 cents.
Understood.
So if I have $2 million worth of $32 transactions, I'm going to get charged significantly more than that one $2 million transaction. Does that help?
Thank you.
Okay, moving back to slide 17. When we were asked to present, we were asked to comment on exemptions and exceptions to use of the master contract. That really isn't the right terminology. There really aren't any exemptions or exceptions. There are compliance and processing considerations that play into the payment acceptance decision process. So bear with me for a moment while I walk you through that. First, agencies must comply with public funds law relative to where state funds can be held, who can hold the funds, and when funds are truly considered state funds. And agencies must also think about payment industry data card standards. So first, Oregon public funds laws. If public funds, public officials must use depositories that are qualified as public funds depositories under ORS Chapter 295. Essentially, that's to protect funds in the case of depository insolvency. DOJ has provided advice in this area with respect to what constitutes public funds and what falls under that requirement. This could be a presentation all on its own, but I raise it just to note that it's important that if a third party holds, manages, or collects funds on behalf of a state agency, it must follow those laws where applicable. Moving on to other considerations, compliance related to industry data security. And again, I'll try to skip through these slides very quickly. Agencies who accept merchant cards must agree to protect their customer data from unauthorized use or disclosure. Failure to do so can result in termination of the ability to accept payment cards, fines, lawsuits, and additional costs that might be associated with a breach. The next slide lists an overview of PCI data security requirements. The overall here is that it's costly to comply, but it's even more costly not to comply. And for this reason, most agencies want to remove card processing from their own networks to simply reduce that compliance scope. The best way to prevent a breach at the agency level is to not have the data there to begin with. With that in mind, many agencies contract with a third party to process those transactions on their behalf. And again, this next slide is just a list of PCI security guidelines. I'm going to skip it, but it's there for you to come back and look at. And it's important just so you know that it applies to those relationships. So let's talk about those varying acceptance solutions. Oftentimes, a key question is, on whose behalf is a third-party vendor working? Most third-party vendors work on behalf of the agency, but some work on behalf of the customer or the payee. The distinction is easiest to explain by providing examples. First, I'll show an example of a vendor who is working on behalf of a state agency. Because they're working on behalf of the public official, the funds are considered under state ownership immediately at collection and fall under public funds law requirements. The second example will show a contract structured to collect funds on behalf of the customer. Those funds are not considered the state's at the time of collection. Instead, they are not considered under state ownership until the very moment that that third-party vendor actually transfers the funds to us. And the distinction is a very fine legal distinction that neither Treasury or DAS or agencies make. It really is a legal decision based on DOJ guidance. So let's look at those examples because it's the easiest way to understand. DMV payments that are made online. This is an example of a provider working on behalf of the state. The vendor in this case is NIC, as DAS's e-government provider. They work to collect funds from customers on behalf of the state. These are state funds the very second that they are collected by the third-party vendor. As such, the provider has to comply with ORS Chapter 295 public funds requirements. These transactions, even though collected through a third-party provider, must settle through the U.S. Bank Elavon relationship and are deposited directly into the state's bank account.
Senator Johnson.
I do have a question. I'm glad you used this example because this is something that has been worrisome to me. In that NIC USA contract with DMV, there is cost recovery. There are several elements of deductions taken from the processing. I'm not saying this very well. And the agency's in the back of the room, so they may be able to help me ask my question. But there is a fee charged for the sale of certain records. And it is not just a processing fee with respect to credit cards. There are all kinds of other elements to the charges. And I am still trying to understand whether those are negotiated one-off or whether this is a common practice. Where that money goes, it seems to be sort of an up and extra that goes into a fund that has been used rather flexibly. And I'm trying to see, how does that happen?
Senator Hayward and Senator Johnson, I'm going to take a stab at answering the question because I think I may understand it. I believe that you are referring to the fee that relates to our e-government program in general. It is actually, I shouldn't say it's unrelated, but it is very distinct from these online merchant card payment acceptance. It is something that is negotiated between DAS, ODOT, and NIC USA for provision of the e-government platform in general, not just related to merchant card payments at all. Those costs are negotiated, really. It's not Treasury that does that. It is a negotiation. I believe that an economist from outside of the process comes in and looks at what the value of those records are, and so that the highway fund is held harmless, that they receive the same amount they would have, if not more, than they would have in the old way that they used to charge for those records. Instead, those funds are collected and remitted to NIC USA for provision of the service. It's a little bit outside of my area of expertise, but I think that's the charge that you speak of.
That is, and Madam Chair, you've helped phrase it. What I'm really looking for, though, is, and again, I'm jumping up to 100,000 feet and sort of saying, as long as we're having this as a policy discussion, to my way of thinking, there ought to be a little greater transparency and clarity about what is cost recovery, what is revenue generated out of these transactions, what goes to satisfy the NIC USA contract. And so I'm just looking for a more transparent relationship with both the credit card processing and these contracts, albeit for a good purpose. And I had the opportunity to meet with you at NIC USA the other day, and what I thought was kind of a sinister transaction is not so. But it certainly seems to lack a transparency that I think many of us pine for.
Noted.
Thanks. And colleagues, first of all, my thanks to Representative Nathanson and Representative Comp and whoever got us started. I didn't realize Representative Smith wasn't going to be here today, and I was stuck somewhere else. I want to make sure that we do have time for the other people who are scheduled to speak. So I want to make sure we get questions. But, Ms. Parker, it looks like you've got about 7 more slides to go, and I don't know how long you're going to need to talk. But, Senator Whitsitt.
I just have one brief question. With the DMV example, you said that the online payments are the highest security risk and so forth. If DMV is already has this in place, why do they not have terminals in their offices? They have 60 field offices. If they had 4 terminals in each field office at $50 a clatter, it would cost them about $12,000 a month, about $144,000 a year just to have the convenience for at the counters. Why don't they have that?
Senator Steinward Hayward and Senator Whitsitt, I'm certainly not going to answer that question on behalf of the agency. I know they have been working closely with us over a number of years to move towards that approach, and we're getting even closer. Again, business decision, there are a variety of factors. I think what's important is the agency is moving in that direction and working to get there as soon as they can. I'm sorry, I don't feel it's my role to answer that question on behalf of that agency or any other.
Representative Guy, are you good to hold for a few minutes?
Sure.
Thank you so much, Ms. Parker.
Okay, let's go to the next one. So as an alternative, let's look at a solution where the vendor is working on behalf of those who are making the payments. The DOJ Division of Child Support has structured contracts with vendors who act as agents for their obligees. These funds are not considered the state's ownership at the time of collection. This third party does not have to settle directly through the U.S. Bank Elavon relationship. Instead, these funds are not considered the state's until they are actually deposited into a state account. They're still considered obligee funds when they are collected by the third party vendor. The distinction is at times very complex. Legal distinction, as I mentioned, is certainly not Treasury who makes the determination, nor the agency. But once that legal distinction has been made, this does trigger the possibility of a different payment collection approach. As noted earlier, I wouldn't really call these exemptions or exceptions, but they are distinct from the relationships that settle directly through our contract. In addition to those underlying contract is serving, agencies need to think about other processing service needs that they might have. Do they need online portal or website development or maintenance services? Does the collection tool need to be linked to a licensing or inventory or similar service? It is not uncommon to consider a third-party vendor for those services. The master contract with U.S. Bank Elavon does have some ability to provide those type of services, but they are over and above the base functionality of the contract and are never mandated to agencies. They are simply one option for an agency to put up against the other options available to them. What third-party provider is ultimately used for those type of services is always an agency business decision. It needs to include compliance considerations, resource and cost issues, and even the prevalence of like industry solutions. For example, the DOJ child support solutions are similarly used across that entire industry. Parks, for example, also uses a third-party vendor that works with other state and county park system. Where it makes sense to use a wheel that's already been created, that option is always available. We were asked the question about providing payment card acceptance services to local governments via a state master contract. The bottom line is that this approach would certainly be negotiable with our vendor. We would, however, have to be thoughtful about how it was created. The initial reaction by the bank was that there would likely be a tiered pricing arrangement based on transaction volumes and types. We would need to structure the contract to protect the state to make sure that any compliance issues were clearly still the responsibility of the local government purchaser and not the state. And we would need to think about the administrative burden to the state as well. The simplest way to deal with that would likely be to structure the contract with a joinder so that the local government could use the buying power of the state, but so the state really had no additional administrative responsibilities other than to negotiate that base contract fee and sort of lend the volume of the state agencies that would also be on it. If there were an administrative burden, that would result in an FTE ask from our office. Finally, I would just like to remind the committee that agencies have a variety of payment options to choose from. Credit and debit card acceptance is just one option. In addition to the variety, you can skip forward. In addition to the variety of alternatives themselves, agencies have options to mandate payment types. We mentioned that earlier. And they have options to offset costs where it makes sense by passing those on to the customer, again, in a transparent manner, as Senator Johnson mentioned earlier. In any case, whatever choice is made should be economically feasible. Agencies should consider business objectives, who the customers are, what services are being provided, the volume of and size of typical payments, the cost of accepting those payments, whether physical acceptance or electronic payments, compliance issues, and depository requirements. In the end, it's always a business decision for the agency, but Treasury is available and does work closely to provide input regarding those alternatives, including their costs and other considerations. And with that, we are at the end.
Thank you very much. Other questions for Ms. Parker? Representative Gomberg, do you have anything else?
Yes, thank you so much, Madam Chair. And to Senator Witsit's question, Senator Johnson and I had heard in TED earlier this year that DMV field offices are planning to come online next year, which will entail about $300 million more in credit card charges, taking the annual total to over $1 billion in this contract. DMV says they're going to experience between $6 and $7 million in transaction costs, but they'll also have the savings in not having to handle as much cash. And Oregonians will save money not having to use ATMs in those field offices. But that was not my question. My question goes back to the exceptions question that was raised earlier, and I had posed that question. Is the Department of Revenue, who currently accepts credit cards for individual tax payments, part of the contract that we've been discussing today?
Senator Hayward and Representative Gomberg, they are one of the agencies that processes payments on behalf of the taxpayer, the consumer. So they are one that does not process directly through the U.S. Bank Elavon contract. Again, I would not say that they are an exception. I would say that their vendor relationship is such that they are providing the service on behalf of the consumer instead of on behalf of the state agency. And I think that they're here today to actually speak to you about more related to that decision.
All right. Thank you.
Ms. Parker, I have one really quick question. You talked about the Treasury consulting with agencies as they think about it. Is one of the calculations that comes into that the cost of processing cash or check payments as opposed to the cost of processing a credit card transaction?
Madam Chair, absolutely. Cost and the variety of costs that play into is certainly part of that consideration.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. Ms. Parker and everybody, thank you so much for your time. Jolene Swint, Department of Revenue. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the subcommittee. I'm Chris Kautz, the Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Revenue, and Jolene Swint is here today with me to talk about how the Department of Revenue does its payment options for taxpayers. What we would like you to know up front is that we try to have a number of open doors so that as taxpayers do owe the state of Oregon, they have many options to take a look at. So I am the driver today, and Jolene is the presenter, so hopefully I can get her where she needs to go, because I can't. I'm not driving. Are you driving, Julie? Okay, here we go. Right here?
Good afternoon, co-chairs and member of the subcommittee.
For the record, my name is Jolene Swint, and I manage the Administrative Services Division Processing Center section of the Department of Revenue. I've been asked today to talk to you about our current payment options that include credit card payments that we offer taxpayers and businesses at Revenue. I have three slides to share with you and answer any questions you may have. Our current payment options that we accept are cash, check, money order, and electronic payment. Our largest volume and dollar amount is received through electronic fund transfer method. As you can see, 70.5% is received this way. This method comes through ACH credit payments, ACH debit or direct debit payments from checking or savings accounts, which include our NIC USA for corporation and payroll tax programs, the direct debit application using U.S. Bank's e-payment app, and Revenue Online, which recently in our rollout one incorporates our corporate and cigarette tobacco tax. Our second largest volume and dollar amount that is received is checks, money orders, and cash. It is right at 29%. Most payments come in with coupons or payment vouchers, and we process them through our high-speed remittance processing, or what you may think of as a banking machine, and we electronic deposit with the U.S. Bank.
Senator Johnson?
Generally, how fast do those transactions take place?
Chair Steiner Hayward, Representative Johnson. Oh, Senator Johnson, sorry. We usually, during our off season, we can turn them around within 24 hours. During our seasonal time of the year, you know, February through June, which is our high volume, it takes a little longer than that, and it's 3 to 7 days for checks or money orders. And sometimes it can extend a little bit longer than that, because sometimes people will send us checks that it's not clearly identified where those checks need to be accounted for. So we have some investigation to do.
Okay, I'm just curious because Ms. Parker put such a high premium on getting the money that is the state's money to work quickly. Mm-hmm. I just had a constituent raise an issue with me on Friday that a five-figure check to satisfy personal income taxes had been sent to you guys, and it's now 8 weeks later, and no processing, no knowledge of where the check is. Repeated inquiries have resulted in we don't know. And it seems to me that if Treasury is interested in getting this money working for us immediately, the kind of lag that you describe, and I'm assuming my constituent situation may be anomalous, but even a couple of weeks, five figures, is not insubstantial. And I'm trying to figure out how often is that the case? Is this, and you've kind of hinted that it is more the norm than it is the exception in your high volume periods.
During our high volume periods, this last season, I believe, we were banking, or once the checks came in and they were clearly identified where they needed to be accounted for, we were within a 3 to 7 day time frame. There are some anomalies where there's several things a taxpayer can do that doesn't benefit them. They can send the check to the wrong post office box. They can identify the check to the IRS. They can put nothing on their check. They cannot sign them. There are times that checks get lost. It's been a very long time since I have seen or heard of it taking 8 weeks for a physical check to be deposited and accounted for.
One more. I have a call into Deanna Mack to try to reconcile that. But it also strikes me that any lag time, I mean, Ms. Parker was so pointed about saying we got to get this money working for us immediately, and you are our point of collection. It also, and this is rhetorical, raises the question when OLCC anticipates that they're going to be having $400,000 a week cash transactions. It raises an interesting question about how that's going to get processed and how fast the money will go to work for our common purposes for government.
Madam Chair.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you. Just to follow up on Senator Johnson's line of questioning, I mean, just a little quick doodling. If you collect about $10 billion in income tax a year and you had a 5% interest return on whatever accounts you put it in, it would be a $500 million account for a year's time. and divide that 365, it's about $1.3 million a day that you're losing by not having it in the account. I mean, that's just very rough figures, but I mean, it is a substantial amount of money. If you're talking 7 days, you're looking at $10 million lost from not having, but just by not getting it into an interest-bearing account. I mean, those are just figures I did in my head, but I mean, it's got to be a substantial amount of money when you're looking at that huge amount of money.
Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Whitsitt, we are hoping in the next couple of years when we get through our gen tax modernization that we will be able to take some of the timing off of depositing the money in within. We're hoping with some of the modernization that will come with gen tax and with some of the other things that we're doing at the department that when the money comes in the door, we will be able to deposit it first and then apply it later if we can't easily identify where it goes. So within the next year or 2 years, we're hoping that that money will be deposited immediately. But currently right now, we have system limitations to doing that. And every check that comes in that is not clearly identified has to be touched by a person to get deposited in the bank and applied correctly.
Madam Chair, it strikes me that this might be an interesting opportunity for a performance measure, given the back-of-the-envelope calculations that Senator Whitsitt did, the amount of money that's hemorrhaging out in a 2-year horizon to rectify that. I think setting some performance objectives about getting money working for us and in deposit would be a very reasonable performance expectation.
Duly noted, Senator. Thank you. Okay. We're good? Keep going. Okay. It's all yours.
So credit card payments that we receive are at 0.5%. We currently have Virtual Merchant, which is a U.S. bank product that we process and pay the merchant fee for. It's primarily used for other agency account debt collection. Other agency account bills the fee to the client agency, and it is paid through the client agency back to the department. The cost is built into the fee structure. We also have value payment systems where the taxpayer can log on and pay a convenience fee to pay their debt. The taxpayers call us or can go to Revenue Online or our current website to get to value payment systems.
Gotcha. I have one further question on that slide.
Sure.
Only about 29% of your money comes in from checks, money order, or cash, which has to be counted and handled. So the 70% or 70.5% that come in on credit payments, debit and direct debit payments, does that go into a bank account immediately or is it there for a week?
Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, Senator Whitsitt, I think there's a mixture. It does not sit there a week, but because of the way that the different options, I cannot tell you exactly. I can give you that information on the how fast it's remitted.
That'd be very helpful.
I can do that.
Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to talk for a moment just about this convenience fee that taxpayers use when they pay online. And we've heard testimony a little while ago that the average used in the treasurer's contract is 1.6% in transaction costs, but this convenience fee that we're asking individual taxpayers to pay is 2.25%, which I understand all goes directly to the bank. And I'm trying to get some sense of how much extra it is costing Oregon taxpayers to pay 2.25% when they charge their taxes compared to the 1.6% that is the average in this other contract that you're choosing to use. And I might also add that from what I've been able to tell, this is the only agency that is actually charging a handling fee or a convenience fee for using credit cards amongst all of the various agencies that we've got.
Chair Steiner Haber, Representative Gomberg. The agency made a business decision about 8 years ago to go to the value payment system and have the taxpayer pay that fee rather than having the general fund do it. There's about 110,000 transactions a year that go through value payment systems. So ballpark, it's about $250,000 that the taxpayer who chooses to pay by a credit card, and they have other options at Revenue. They don't have to pay that transaction fee, but that they pay themselves rather than having the general fund pay that component. So $500,000 a biennium. And you're right, the difference is the roughly 0.6%, But again, the agency then would have to pay that cost. And we made the choice back in the day not to do that. If the choice is different now or want us to go in a different direction, we can certainly take a look at that.
Senator Whitson.
Well, yeah, it would be interesting to see when you are collecting a convenience fee that has a deterrent effect on the credit card user, I would assume. And so that might encourage them to send a check, which then you have to handle and hold for a week. Or, you know, I'd be exaggerating a little bit, but I mean, it seems to me to be counterintuitive if you're trying to get money in quickly and put it in an account to put an impediment in their way. And I don't expect an answer. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to need to keep rocking and rolling, people.
Okay.
So,
the next slide indicates the total dollars by payment type. This slide is representation of the last 4 years. As you can see, all payment methods show a slight gain in dollar amount every year, but seem to stay pretty steady. Taxpayer or businesses get comfortable with their vehicle of payment method and don't seem to change unless they have to or run into an issue that forces them to. The department's plan for future payment options. At Department of Revenue, we're always looking for a more efficient means to provide our payment options. With each rollout of our core system replacement, we'll be able to extend online payment processing through Gentax. We continually are looking internally, reviewing our current processes and options. And of course, we desire to keep aligned with industry payment best practices. Really, what we want is to have the ability to give the taxpayer, businesses, and non-taxpayers all in any vehicle possible to pay their debts in a process that they feel secure in doing it through.
Thank you, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. I think we're going to hang tight for the moment, and I think this is useful and helpful. Thank you very much. Okay, moving right along, Mr. Schmidt, yes, from AOC, and whoever else is keeping you company. Folks, we got about 15 minutes left, and I apologize to those of you at the end of the agenda. This is and I apologize for getting a late start, but we're going to try to get the basics in, and we'll see where we go from there. Thank you very much.
Chair Steiner Haywood, members of the committee, my name is Mary Stern, and I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and with me today is Eric Schmidt, AOC's Communications Manager. I want to apologize to you for not having a great presentation like the previous presenters. We got a very general request for information and then a more specific one last Thursday, and we got that out to our folks as soon as we could, but before a long weekend, we really didn't get too many responses back. We have a saying at AOC, which many of you have heard, when you've seen one Oregon county, you've seen one Oregon county. And we got pretty much the same response back when we asked our counties how they deal with debit and credit cards. Very different among all the counties, but there were some similarities. And let's see. You actually were provided with a document that we've handed out that contains the responses from either our administrators, treasurers, or those involved in collecting fees. We're very happy to put that into a more cohesive presentation for you as time permits, if that would be helpful to you. But many of our counties negotiate the credit card terms with their vendors. Point and Pay and Elavon are prominent vendors. Credit cards can be used to pay property taxes, fines, fees in most of our counties. The fees for the credit card are generally in the range of 2.5% to 3%, and particularly with the property taxes, those are picked up by the taxpayer. And I think to the point that was made just previously, in Clackamas County, they collect about $500 million in property tax per year. Only $7 million of that is via credit cards. And I think that it could be a deterrent for folks to pay with credit cards since they are having to pay the fee themselves. I know it's a deterrent to me to pay for my property tax that way. Deschutes County spends an estimated $100,000 a year on credit card charges. It's considered the cost of doing business with the public to them. Deschutes doesn't use very many credit cards to purchase goods for county use. They have about a dozen cards or so for that purpose. And those cards are usually used for purchasing items through the internet and for employee travel arrangements. Jackson County negotiates with credit card companies directly. They use Point and Pay for property tax payments online, and the customers there pay 2.5% fee. Their clerk and community justice programs do the same for fees and fines. Jackson County also uses Elavon for other credit card processing, and fees are paid by the county in those areas. And I mention this because several other counties also follow Jackson County's model. We'd have to dig a lot deeper, and we're willing to do that if you would like us to. We do hear from our counties that they want flexibility to be able to negotiate themselves with the credit card companies to get the best deal possible. In addition, many counties like being able to work with their local banks, the ones that are in their communities, and they like the flexibility that the local connection provides. And in terms of having counties participate in a state contract, if that participation is voluntary, I think that would AOC would be supportive of that. However, if it's mandated, such participation would be problematic, especially with the length of contracts that their counties are involved in currently. So with that, I'll try and answer any questions, or I'd be happy to gather more information for you.
Senator Johnson, do you have a question?
She answered my question. I was trying to figure out to maximize the purchasing power in negotiating on the contracts, whether or not the counties would participate, and you answered it.
Great. Any other questions? Senator Whitson.
Thank you. On the handout you had here, you have the average number of total number of transactions, about 11.2 million, and your total handle of about $252 million comes out to about $22 a transaction. What can you buy in a county or a city for $22?
Which county is this, Senator?
This is the aggregate for the League of Oregon Cities.
Oh, that will be Ms. Johnson will be right up after us. That was the Association of Oregon Counties.
Well, why wouldn't you know that? Oh.
All right, let's let the AOC people off the hook and let the LOC people come on up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time and your patience sitting through. Hopefully it's helpful to you to sit through these other presentations.
Very helpful.
Great. Thank you so much. All right. LOC people, come on down. Great. Okay, before you even get started, 114 out of, I should know the answer, how many cities do we have in the state of Oregon?
242. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I see at the bottom. Sorry about that. That's a pretty darn good response rate. Wow. As a surveyor, I'm impressed. Okay, keep going.
Co-Chair Senator Hayward, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. And I have with me today Sandra Montoya from the City of Salem. She's the Assistant Finance Director to help with technical questions since she deals with the credit card issues for the city. We got the request from LFO, from John Borden, to get some information regarding credit cards. It was kind of a general question, but we apparently asked a number of the right questions. We got the more detailed request. We gave the survey out to our cities. They had a week to get back to us, and Thursday was our deadline. And so we did get a good response. I want to thank Representative Gomberg for reaching out to the cities. It's an important issue. Anytime we can save money for cities, we're interested in. So I think that is a big reason why you do see a great response rate, even right before a long weekend. So I have, I think, 8 slides, so I think I can keep it to 8 minutes. We did have 114 cities respond, and they were from different sizes of cities. Of those that responded, 68% permit credit card payments right now. And if they don't, it's the big reason is because of the cost. For those that do permit credit card payments, 64% permit it for all types of city services. And if there is an exclusion, there wasn't really a predominant exclusion except for the system development charges, the SDCs, which tend to be, you know, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, depending on what kind of project. I mean, they're definitely bigger numbers. And so you can imagine why cities have excluded that payment. And then there's a smattering of other exclusions. Some don't allow it for court fines or lodging taxes or building permits and things. Of those responded, we asked if they had a maximum or minimum requirement. Almost no one had a minimum requirement, but there were some maximums, but there was no consistent number. A few cities had a $1,000 max, a few had a $5,000, and then a couple had a $10,000 maximum. But there were actually quite a few in the $300 to $500 as their maximum. So we're talking mostly about utility bills and things like that that a city would be providing, that's what a common credit card payment would be for. We asked about online payments, and 80% do permit online payments, and then 87% permitted at using a credit card at the city office or some other business place. Very few cities charge a convenience or service fee, only about 20%, and those fees really varied. They seem to be all less than $3, but some of them were based on a percent, and those percentages were all less than 3%. The next slide here. This is probably the most important number that I think LFO was looking for. What is our per transaction? As you heard from the Treasury, there are the three types of fees that go into a credit card fee, and there's the only the one that's negotiable. And as we heard from Treasury, the state's negotiated dollar or cent is 7 cents per transaction. And from our cities that we heard back from, our average was 34 cents, and we had a range of 8 cents at the lowest, which was our largest city who was able to negotiate that, and then the highest rate was $1.79 per transaction. So we can see that if we were able to get onto the state's negotiated rate, our cities would definitely save money based on the rate. And then also the convenience and service charge fee. Sounds like only now the Department of Revenue has that, but that's something our cities wrote back that they would be interested in using that system because that tends to be a negotiated issue as well. Of our 114 responding cities, only two of them that responded have a cooperative agreement with another government. One was with another city and one was with a county. But it's not very common. It's sort of a new concept. But apparently some contracts will have that ability to piggyback onto another contract. So that's something that they're very interested in exploring. 60% of those that responded would be interested in using the state's contract. 32% weren't sure. It would depend on what the details and the rates would be. And only 8% were not interested. And the reason they weren't interested was either because they don't want to offer credit card payments at all. Some are really small cities. Or they have a really great rate, the 8-cent transaction, and seem to be the only reasons not to be interested. So here are the details on our dollar amounts and number of transactions, since those seem to set the rates. Our largest cities, the average is a little over 1 million transactions a year, and then our smaller cities are just over 1,600 is the average. And so the aggregate of the 53 cities that did respond was 11.2 million. I did some quick math, and it looks like about half of our largest cities responded, about a third of our medium-sized cities responded, and only about a quarter of our smaller cities did. So I would estimate that it's probably a little over double that if we took all of our cities, if those averages are, the respondents are similar to what we did get back. So we probably have 22 million or so transactions a year. It'd be a rough estimate, but we could do more surveying if that would be helpful. And then on the credit card dollar value, the largest cities do a little over 21 million a year, and our smallest cities are doing about $168,000. Dollars in credit card transactions a year. And these are some really small cities. The next slide has the population chart, and you can get a better version on the League of Oregon Cities webpage, but most of our cities are definitely in the less than 5,000 size, so there's quite the gamut of value of transactions that would be done in a year. So I've sped through them. We just really want to again thank the committee for asking for the information. We think that there's some value and some cost savings that could be passed on to local governments, and we'd be happy to do more research if that's needed. We didn't get into the third-party issue, for example. A few cities do use third-party vendors, but it doesn't seem to be very common. But there are some other issues, obviously, that are unexplored that I'm sort of learning as we listen to the committee. But I'd be happy to answer any questions and then also ask if Sandra had anything to add.
Representative Gumber.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Is there any legislation that stands in the way of you working with the treasurer with this larger contract, or is it? Do you need any legislative fixes?
Co-Chair, Senator Hayward, Representative Gumber, I'm not aware of anything. I think it would be more whether the state is allowed to contract or permit us, and then if so, what that fee would be, and whether that would need to be established by rule or legislation. I'm not certain, but the state contracting program that we already use, that's a fee provision, and we're permitted, we have that agreement with the state and pay the fee, but our relationship then is directly with the vendor. If it would be something similar, that would be, I don't think that requires a lot of legislation. I think it's just an authority.
Sandra may know more.
Sandra Montoya, Assistant Finance Director with the City of Salem. Thank you for the opportunity. To my knowledge, there is not any legislative changes needed.
Other questions? Wow. Thank you all very much. I'd like to thank Representative Gomberg for all the work that he's been doing on this issue. I think we've learned a lot, and I want to thank people from Treasury and Revenue and AOC and LOC for their willingness to participate in this conversation. We're always looking at ways to make things smoother and easier for the citizens of Oregon and more efficient and more economical and get money working faster for the state of Oregon. So I think this hearing has helped us think about one other aspect of all of those questions. Committee, any other questions? Representative Gomberg, anything you want to add at the tail end of this?
Well, thank you so much, Madam Co-Chair. I just wanted to thank you and the committee for the invitation, the opportunity to participate today, and to all the people that presented information and worked with me previous on this. I think there's some opportunities for some savings, particularly at the local level. I think there's some interesting questions at the state level. One of the things that did not come out today is Senator Johnson and I discovered that the largest single transaction that we've been able to discern that was put on a credit card with the state of Oregon last year was $1.99 million. Somebody's got an obviously higher credit limit than I do, that our transaction cost on that one particular charge was about $40,000. So there's some interesting questions out there.
Okay. Excellent.
Almost as big as the recon they made.
Yeah. Okay. Any other business before the committee? Julie, we're good? Kim, we're good? All right, we're adjourned. Thank you very much. So good. All right, we're adjourned. Thank you very much.